the 17th century was a remarkable period in the history of science, notable for major advances in mathematical physics and the experimental study of nature. The first public society dedicated to this experimental approach was the Royal Society of London, founded in 1660. And shortly afterwards, the first scientific journal, the Philosophical Transactions, was instituted. There were several characteristic features of this new experimental practice, the most striking being the use of instruments to generate reliable scientific data that could be verified by others following the same procedures. Nature was now being manipulated through the use of technology to give up her secrets. Another characteristic was the successful application of mathematics to the physical world, notably in the fields of astronomy, mechanics, and optics. Both space and time were subjected to more and more precise measurements as newly invented instruments such as the telescope, 1609, and spring balance watch, 1660, were developed. It was the Italian natural philosopher Galileo Galilei who, in his book Il Saggiatore, the Assayer, of 1623, insisted that the universe operated according to mathematical principles. While it was Isaac Newton's revolutionary book, Principia Mathematica, or the Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy, published in 1687, that contained the three laws of motion, which dominated the scientific view of the universe for the next 300 years and beyond. Among cultural historians, there has been considerable discussion about the broader context of this new experimental trend in early modern Europe. In particular, debate has focused on the growing importance of observation to Westerners, at the same time that literacy and the ability to assimilate visual data increased due to the impact of the printing press. One influential argument by Marshall McLuhan and Walter Ong has been that early modern Western culture developed a distinctively visualist bias at the expense of the other senses. Ong's thesis, in particular, was that pre-modern and non-literate societies are predominantly oral-aural in character and consequently have a magical, animated conception of the world. He claimed that literate scientific societies, on the other hand, chiefly rely on sight, where the rational observer is effectively detached from the world that he surveys. Ong argued that an epistemic shift from hearing to vision took place in the 16th and 17th centuries as Europeans became increasingly literate and therefore more modern and scientific in outlook. Scholars such as Michel Foucault, Svetlana Alpers, and David Harvey have continued this visualist argument to the point that it is now taken for granted that new visual technologies since the Renaissance, including linear perspective, and the camera obscura, as well as the telescope and microscope, dramatically altered how Westerners came to imagine and even to dominate the world. Academic focus on the eye may itself reflect a bias in Western perception, but it does mean that there is a huge gap in early modern sensory history that is only slowly being filled by sensory studies in general and sound studies in particular. Given the active nature of early modern Western visuality, should we not also consider how new oral technologies and sound organization may have affected Western hearing and thinking at the same time as they transformed the European soundscape? Later periods have been comparatively well attended to, notably in histories of the telephone, phonograph, radio, and electronic music, which speculate on their wider experiential and cognitive impact. It is surprising, then, that only reluctantly are early modernists outside of musicology coming to reflect on some of the striking changes that took place in musical practice in their period, a process involving new instrumental technologies and modes of performance, as well as new ways of listening to and responding to music. At the same time, only a handful of scholars, including myself, has attended to corresponding changes in musical science and its relationship to the broader scientific movement that I've just explained was taking place in this period. My research has therefore been comparatively unusual in that its persistent attention to sound, particularly the the organized kinds of sounds we identify as music or harmony has led me to discover the surprisingly intimate connection between making music and the emergence of experimental science, mediated through the use of instruments. At the heart of my work is the claim that developments in 16th century musical practice had a perceivable impact on how philosophers thought about nature in the 17th century, the realm of scientific knowledge. At the same time, the related concepts of harmony and sympathy, as understood through musical experience, proved to be powerful models for those who had grasped the dynamic structure and workings of the cosmos. However, as I will explain shortly, instead of revealing a simple relationship between the domains of music and the new science, my research has shown that music was also strongly implicated in the natural magic of the period, a practice which involved secret and occult powers in nature to bring about extraordinary effects. At this point, it is appropriate to note that knowledge was classified somewhat differently in the early modern period compared to present-day terminology. Thus, for example, the term science, scientia, simply meant theory or systematic knowledge of a discipline, while art, ars, denoted its practical application. The idea of practicing science was therefore a contradiction in terms. Rather than science, I prefer to use the contemporary term natural philosophy, which means wisdom about nature, while the ability to bring about effects mostly fell into the category of natural magic, a practice which attracted considerable attention in the decades around 1600. In brief, magic in general was an art which either used supernatural agency to bring about marvellous effects, this was demonic magic, or else relied on secret, occult forces in nature to bring about the same extraordinary results, which was known as natural or spiritual magic. Within this conceptual framework, music might be regarded as magical because of its potential power over the imagination, bringing about changes in mood or behaviour by insensible, that is, imperceptible means. We will return later to natural magic, but first I want to draw your attention to music's place in the system of knowledge and how this has also changed over the passage of time. Nowadays, music is classified as a performing art, the single most important reason why it has mostly been left out of histories of science. Yet, until the middle of the 18th century, music was generally counted among the mathematical disciplines, specifically the branch of mathematics known as harmonics. In its narrowest sense, harmonics is the study of the mathematical relations underlying the structure of audible music. But there was also a broader conception of harmonics which went back to Ptolemy and even Plato, a tradition which assumes that the structures of music have their analogues in the soul and in the heavens, and therefore astronomy and music are intimately related. An image taken from the Rosicrucian physician Robert Fludd's Utrius Quae Cosmi Historia, or History of the Macrocosm and Microcosm of 1619, graphically shows this relationship between astronomy and music in the form of a universal monochord, a device for demonstrating the mathematical relationships between musical pitches. This conception of the universe is based on the presumption that nature is intrinsically musical. Fludd's book was one of four major treatises on the subject of universal harmony, which were published in the early 17th century. The others were Johannes Kepler's Harmonia Mundi, Harmony of the World, 1619, Marin Mersenne's Harmonie Universelle, Universal Harmony, of 1636, and Athanasius Kircher's Musurgia Universalis, Universal Music Making, of 1650. All of these authors believed, like Galileo, that the universe was constructed according to mathematical principles, and that the ratios of musical intervals were an important component of that structure. At the same time, this essentially Platonic view of music as sound in mathematics was complemented by its place among the liberal arts and their sciences. Thanks to Aristotle and his followers, Music was understood to be linked to poetry and oratory, a means of enhancing the power of words through song, and therefore having a direct influence on morals and behaviour. During the Renaissance, it became fashionable for the nobility to practice art music themselves, which accordingly gained high social and intellectual status. At the same time, the revival of ancient texts unknown to the Middle Ages provided a rich vein of resources which alluded to music's quasi-miraculous powers in antiquity, effects which some philosophers thought might be reproduced in modern times if the right kind of instruments and performance techniques could be discovered. One of the most important figures, musical figures in the ancient world was Pythagoras, who was believed to be Plato's teacher. On the theoretical side, legend taught that Pythagoras was the first to discover the numerical relationships governing musical consonants, the octave being in the ratio 1 to 2, the fifth 2 to 3, and the fourth 3 to 4, and to show that the same ratios govern the distances between planets from the Earth to Saturn, as is shown in this figure. Pythagoras was also credited with the invention of the monochord, an instrument which demonstrated these relationships experimentally through string length ratios. On the practical side, Pythagoras was reputed to cure diseases and modify passions through the power of his singing and playing on the lyre, instrumental skills he possessed because of his unparalleled knowledge of the harmony which operated throughout nature. In other words, Pythagoras was understood to have practiced a form of natural magic. As I will demonstrate in the course of this lecture, these stories exercised an important influence on 16th and 17th century philosophical thought in both the positive and negative sense. This ambiguity towards ancient philosophy is particularly noticeable, for example, in the work of Francis Bacon, who, unlike his contemporary Robert Flood, apparently had little time for Pythagoras. Bacon is important to us here because of his ambition to develop a system of philosophy that rejected scholastic principles, especially Aristotle's, and instead used an experimental method for generating new and improved kinds of knowledge, including a new physics. How this method was supposed to work can be demonstrated through a study of the discipline he first identified in Latin as Acoustica in 1623, and then went on to discuss in more detail in his Silva Silvarum, which was published posthumously in 1626. It is important to note that Bacon referred to this work as a higher kind of natural magic, which explains why it presents a range of unusual phenomena and exhorts the reader to investigate their hidden or occult causes. In fact, Bacon actually rejected most forms of magic as illegitimate, but thought he could create a new, useful kind that would avoid shortcuts and other dangers of normal magical practice. The study of audibles, or things heard, Bacon outlined in the Silva, was part of a larger ambition to produce a comprehensive natural history of the senses. Thus, the Silva was divided into 1,000 experiments, 100 in each of 10 chapters, that were to provide an empirical basis for discovering the fundamental causes of various sensory phenomena. Within his experimental framework, what counted was that sound, including music and the voice, was a significant source of power, sonic power that could be controlled to bring about predictable effects on things and people. One aim was the perfection of instruments to communicate secretly or over long distances or to improve hearing range. In other words, the speaking trumpet and hearing trumpet. Another aim was to arouse wonder and delight, like that wonder aroused by automatic musical devices already introduced at the English court by the engineers Cornelius Drebbel and Salomon de Cos. Most significantly, Bacon sought to investigate the nature of music, on the grounds that most music theory and mathematics was full of mystical subtleties and little truth. Nevertheless, the deep concern with which Bacon mapped out his acoustical program in the Silva hints at the link with Renaissance natural magic, in which practical music occupied an honored, eminent position. In particular, Bacon emphasized the importance of studying the proportional and instrumentally organized sound that he identified as harmony. Quote, the sweetest and best harmony being when every part or instrument is not heard by itself, but a conflation of them all. One direct source of inspiration for Bacon's observations seems to have been the music he heard at the English court, which under the early Stuarts had the largest permanent musical household in Europe. For example, he evidently paid attention to experiments by the king's private players, who were using different configurations of instruments in their consort music, since he notes that, I quote, all concords and discords of music are, no doubt, sympathies and antipathies of sounds. And so, likewise, in that music which we call broken music or consort music, some consorts of instruments are sweeter than others, a thing not sufficiently yet observed. But for the melioration of music, there is yet much left to try and inquire. Bacon also referred to an extensive range of musical instruments from brass to strings, and proposed a series of experiments to see how the materials used in their construction, as well as the length and thickness of strings or pipes, determine qualities such as pitch or what we would call timbre. Apart from the investigation of harmony, Bacon was certain that his experimental method could also uncover the cause of sympathy, a topic fundamental to occult philosophy as one of the organizing principles of the universe. A more localized source of interest for Bacon was that court musicians and instrument makers known to him were exploring different ways of using sympathetic resonance to enrich their music making. For example, there was the instrument called the polyphant, invented by Daniel Farrant, which was strung with the cores of sympathetic strings running beside the strings actually being played. The phenomenon could also be simply demonstrated by showing that a musical tone produced by a string on one lute can cause a string on another instrument, tuned at the unison or octave, to vibrate at a distance. This figure is a Dutch engraving made around 1627 that shows this phenomenon at work. And you can see the two lutes and the on the just below the bridge, this little paper or whatever it is, which is moving to show how it's functioning. In natural magic, this kind of action of a distance, where the cause of the sympathetic relationship between two vibrating strings was hidden, served as a model for other mysterious forces in nature, such as gravity and magnetism. Yet despite this suggestive link between music and the cosmos, Bacon rejected the idea of a musically configured universe and the reliance on harmony as an omnibus explanation for phenomena. In his experimental philosophy, music was to be studied as part of physics in the context of the new discipline of acoustics. Within this scheme, musical instruments effectively became philosophical or scientific instruments, which, if used in the right way, would lead to the understanding of the great secret of numbers and proportions governing musical consonants. I have dwelt on Bacon's ideas at some length to show the place of music within his experimental philosophy, which came to exercise a significant and growing influence, especially on his English followers. A number of his experiments and similar investigations were actually carried out during the course of the 17th century as the field of acoustics developed. However, I should point out that Bacon himself was more of a philosopher than an experimentalist, because he does not seem to have undertaken any research himself into musical phenomena, nor indeed into any other field of inquiry that he mapped out so carefully. Also, we should be wary of accepting Bacon's suggestion that prevailing music theory was mostly useless, or that no one before him had engaged in musical experiments. Although he would have been unaware of the fact, it turns out that one person in particular had already been active in investigating the nature of musical consonants, inspired, it seems, by no less a figure than Pythagoras himself. Not coincidentally for my argument, this individual was none other than the Florentine musician Vincenzo Galilei, father of the more illustrious Galileo Galilei, who is renowned for developing a new kind of mathematical physics. The fact that father and son were both skilled in music was a crucial element of their respective experimental work. Vincenzo Galileo's musical experiments took place sometime in the 1580s, within the context of a group of Florentine poets and musicians who were dedicated to recovering the glory of ancient Greek dramatic music. This lost sonic art had apparently powerful moved emotions. The group's approach was to interrogate ancient sources coupled with experiments in setting verse to instrumental accompaniment to see if this emotional effect could be recreated in modern times. From the perspective of music history, the most interesting outcomes of this activity were the invention of monody, an affective vocal solo line with chordal harmony, and also the development of opera. From the perspective of the history of science, however, one significant but unintended outcome was the first documented attempt to test the results of a series of experiments apparently performed some 2,000 years earlier by the Greek magus Pythagoras. As I have already explained, it was Pythagoras who was credited with the discovery known since antiquity that the musical consonances of the octave, fifth and fourth could be expressed in terms of simple arithmetical ratios that corresponded to string lengths, the understanding being that the faster a string moved, the higher the pitch. However, it is important to know that until the 17th century, there was no understanding or proof that pitch is proportional to frequency, or that frequency is also dependent on other variables, such as the tension and thickness of a string, or the length and width of a pipe, etc. Nor was it known that the oscillations of a vibrating string are isochronous, that is, independent of amplitude, and that this property is similar to that of pendulums, which also vibrate isochronously within limits. Instead, music theorists followed the 6th century philosopher Boethius in stating that the cause of consonants lay in the numbers that represented the musical consonances. The Boethian tradition taught that Pythagoras discovered the correspondence between simple numerical ratios and the musical consonances when he went past a forge, where he heard the blacksmith's hammers giving off harmonious sounds in relation to each other. This image is taken from a 16th century music theory book and shows how Pythagoras supposedly weighed the different hammers, each of which made a particular musical sound. Reportedly, he found an arithmetical relationship between the weights of the hammers and their respective pitches, which can be expressed as 12 to 9 to 8 to 6. And then he went on to invent the monochord, which shows the same arithmetical relationship between the string lengths that produce the octave, fifth, and fourth. In other words, the ratios 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and 3 to 4. As we see illustrated in this image, this time taken from a late 15th century music theory book, the same simple integers corresponding to pitches are supposedly found in the weight stretching equal strings, shown in the bottom left-hand corner, in the lengths of the musical pipes on the bottom right-hand side, in the size of musical bells and the volume of musical glasses in the upper right-hand side. And although it might seem remarkable, no one seems to have checked out and verified Pythagoras' findings for nearly 2,000 years. Vincenzo Galilei seems to have put Pythagoras to experimental trial in the same spirit in which he and his colleagues were experimenting with new musical forms to imitate ancient practices. He apparently began this process in the late 1580s while Galileo was living with him in Florence. Through repeated trials, Vincenzo discovered that a variety of ratios other than those using 1 to 4 and their multiples could cause consonants in glasses, pipes, and strings. In particular, He discovered that the weights suspended from strings in the ratio 2:1 did not produce the octave. Instead, Vincenzo found that to make strings of equal length sound an octave apart, weights have to be in the squared proportion 4:1, not 2:1. He also demonstrated on his lute that pitch in strings can be varied not just by length or tension, but also by changing their thickness or the material out of which they are made. Although Vincenzo did not establish any laws, he nevertheless undermined the fundamental principles that had previously governed consonants. The story of Pythagoras was shown to be untrue. Also, significantly, Vincenzo had made a real musical instrument the subject of theoretical analysis, making it in effect a piece of laboratory equipment. With his father's example in mind, it should perhaps be no surprise that Galileo's musical training, specifically as a lutenist, equipped him with cognitive skills that were to serve him well in his attempt to find an accurate way to measure the motion of falling bodies. His musical proficiency involved a sharp ear, an ability to tune the lute and other instruments accurately, and a well-developed sense of musical time, in particular, the ability to measure small, equal divisions of time for a sustained period. It turns out that these technical skills were highly relevant to Galileo's new experimental method that he began developing in the early decades of the 17th century. One major problem was that there were no timekeepers available to him that were precise enough to measure speed accurately. Galileo researched the characteristics of pendulums in his early career, and after investigating their behaviour, he tried to use them as time measurement devices in later experiments. In 1638, Galileo published his Discourses concerning two new sciences, in which he presents his first law of the pendulum, together with the laws of falling bodies and inclined planes, all of which have been discovered partly through a process of experimenting with specially constructed instruments. The law is that the frequency of a pendulum is inversely proportional to the square root of its length. So in other words, if a pendulum of 1 unit of length vibrates once a second, a pendulum of 4 units, that's 2 squared, vibrates every 2 seconds. The context in which Galileo describes the isochronous motion of pendulums is essentially musical, and indeed it is possible to argue that he could not have created his motion experiments without the musical training that he had received from his father. One of Galileo's motion experiments in particular shows how important his musical training was for developing new techniques of measurement. This experiment involved rolling a ball repeatedly down an inclined plane around which a series of frets were tied. These frets were gradually adjusted so that the bumping sounds that occurred when the ball went over them finally came at half-second intervals, precise units of time which Galileo was able to calculate with a high degree of accuracy. The idea of using adjustable frets was most likely to occur only to a lutenist or viol player who would be accustomed to using this technique for fretting instruments. More significantly, however, Galileo's experiment relied crucially on the musician's internalized clock as a means of marking small, equal units of time over a sustained period. It has been argued that from this experiment later came Galileo's idea for a timing device which used the weight of the water flowing during the swing of a pendulum to establish the rule I have already described. That is, quadrupling the length of the pendulum doubles the duration of its swing, leading to his discovering the law of the acceleration of falling bodies. Another important figure in the quest for more accurate measurement in the 17th century was the French minime friar Marin Mersenne, the author of Harmonie Universelle, published in 1636. This book was meant to be a compendium of everything a musician should know, a body of knowledge which included the physical and mathematical properties of musical sound, which he dealt with in the first volume, before moving on to discuss performance and musical instruments. This introductory material was included because Mersenne believed that the universe is constructed harmonically, and that these cosmic proportions govern the principles of musical practice. Mersenne's contribution to 17th century acoustics and musical science can hardly be overestimated. During the 1620s and 1630s, he engaged in a comprehensive investigation into the nature of sound, including the measurement of its speed. Musical instruments provided him with experimental apparatus for investigating many different properties of sound, not just pitch. Also drawing on the empirical knowledge of instrument makers and performers, Mersenne's publications were unparalleled in their breadth of coverage and depth of detail about the structure, properties, and tunings of specific instruments, thus providing us with a vital source of information for the reconstruction of 17th century performance practice. For my purposes today, Mersenne's most significant contribution was his discovery of the rules governing the vibration of musical strings and pendulums. In modern terms, he established, first, that frequency is inversely proportional to string length. So the shorter the string, the higher the note. So that if a string 2 units in length has a frequency of 220 Hz, a string 1 unit long has a frequency of 440 Hz. Second, he established that frequency is proportional to the square root of string tension. In other words, the higher the tension, the higher the frequency. So if 1 kilo gives 220 Hz, then 4 kilo gives 440 Hz. Thirdly, Mersenne established that frequency is inversely proportional to the square root of the string's thickness. That is, the thinner the string, the higher the frequency. So if a string 4 millimeters thick gives 220 Hz, a string 1 millimeter thick gives 440 Hz. He also discovered independently from Galileo that the frequency of a pendulum is inversely proportional to the square root of its length. So as I've already said, if a pendulum 4 units long vibrates once every 2 seconds, a pendulum 1 unit long vibrates every second. Mersenne's laws, as they are known today, provided a powerful model for other natural philosophers searching for quantitative laws in the physical world. Through regular correspondence about his experiments and their mathematics, he certainly got the young Christian Huygens, whose father was also a noted lutenist and stock songwriter, interested in the science of music and its relationship to the motion of pendulums. This proved to be vital for the latter's invention of the pendulum clock, which Huygens patented in 1657. Mersenne also recognized that his laws might have practical applications, some of which were eventually realized after his death in 1648. For example, he suggested that the pendulum might prove useful to musicians for maintaining standards of pitch and time. In fact, evidence for musicians keeping time with pendulum dates from the 1660s, shortly after Huygens developed the pendulum clock. In 1676, the author of Music's Monument, Thomas Mace, suggested that his readers use a pendant to learn how to keep regular time as, quote, a better and more certain way than counting the numbers 1 to 4 evenly. Henry Purcell outlines a similar technique in his revised edition of Playford's Introduction to the Skill of Music of 1694. Mersenne had also thought that the pendulum might prove useful to physicians measuring the human pulse. In fact, the first pulse watches appeared in the 1690s, based on the technology of the spring balance that had first been applied to clocks and watches by Christian Huygens and the English natural philosopher Robert Hooke sometime around 1660. It seems that probable that Hooke first had the idea, but Huygens is likely to have been the first to produce a functioning watch that used a balanced spring. This mention of Robert Hooke brings us to his activities in the newly founded Royal Society, which I have already explained was established in 1660. Hooke was appointed as the Society's first curator of experiments and was therefore responsible for its weekly experimental agenda. As a result, musical topics played some part in these early meetings, not least because Hooke himself was interested in music. In particular, he was interested in the physics of musical instruments, including sympathetic resonance, and the musical laws of Mersenne, which were among the earliest quantitative laws to be established. It is notable, for example, that when music became a subject of discussion at a society meeting in February 1662, it was explicitly linked to theories of vibration and time measurement. The year 1664 was particularly fruitful for musical topics. In July and August, Hooke performed a series of experiments which demonstrated the validity of Mersenne's laws, which we will see form the basis of his theory of matter. Also in August of 1664, a professional musician was brought into the Royal Society to test his powers of musical judgment, in which unfortunately he was found wanting. In October of the same year, a curious instrument called the archivar was presented to members. This was a kind of barrel organ in the shape of a keyboard instrument, in which the strings are set in motion by a parchment bow turned by a handle. However, few musical activities seem to have taken place in the society during the rest of the century, even though Hooke himself was evidently still interested in musical topics, most notably between 1672 and 1676. Although Hooke never published systematically on his cosmological theories, he left sufficient evidence to show that his conception of the universe, the macrocosm, and of human nature, the microcosm, was fundamentally musical. In a text written sometime in the 1670s, he observed that nature acts regularly and geometrically, and that, quote, God by nature has framed our bodies also according to geometrical rules. He went on to say that men have a body harmoniously constructed and an harmonious soul to be affected thereby. 'Twas Pythagoras and diverse others of the ancient philosophers that by search and inquiry found out the true reason of it, which I suppose might be one of the reasons why he and Plato asserted the soul to be made of numbers. For Hooke, one of the key demonstrations of this principle is the process of music perception, where a clear correspondence can be made between the vibrations of a musical string and the perception of a musical tone, really functioning like a resonating instrument. In this regard, he followed Mersenne in the assumption that the more frequently musical vibrations strike the ear, the higher the pitch perceived. From this principle came an explanation for the perception of consonants, namely, that the more frequently the vibrations of two musical tones coincide with each other, the more pleasing their sound. Underpinning Hooke's experimental work was a theory of matter, which visualized the universe as being made up of tiny particles that act like vibrating strings, with their motions following Mersenne's laws. This analogy agreed with his discovery of what is now known as Hooke's laws of elasticity, which states that the extension of a spring is in direct proportion with the load added to it. For example, if a spring extends by 2 centimetres for a mass of 1 kilo, then it extends by 4 centimetres for a mass of 2 kilo. Hooke also suggested that a vibrating spring is dynamically equivalent to a pendulum. For Hooke, the fact that vibrating bodies such as strings follow demonstrable musical laws was sufficient to argue that the same laws were followed by much smaller, invisible bodies which constituted the basic building blocks of nature. The differences in their frequency provided Hooke with the basis for explaining variety in fluids and solids and phenomena such as gravitational attraction. Just as the three factors determining pitch are length, tension and bigness, that is, cross-sectional area, so the analogous properties of matter or substance, figure or shape, and body or bulk are those which determine frequency in particles of matter. He explained his argument in the following passage of his Micrographia of 1665, a pioneering work based on his discoveries of hitherto invisible realms through the use of the compound microscope. And he writes, particles that are all similar will, like so many musical strings equally stretched, vibrate together in a kind of harmony or unison, whereas others that are dissimilar will make quite differing kinds of vibrations and repercussions, so that both types of particle may be moved, yet are their vibrations so different that they cannot agree together but fly back from each other to their similar particles. So there's sympathy and antipathy at work in the universe. This analogy goes some way towards explaining why Hooke's musical experiments made for the Royal Society were not just a case of proving Mersenne correct in his laws. It was on the basis of simple and verifiable experiments using strings and other vibrating bodies that Hooke could claim analogous principles were operating beyond the range of ordinary sense perception. The justification by experiments that could be reliably witnessed and reproduced was one of the basic principles of the early Royal Society's new scientific method. And for Hooke at least, musical experiments proved to be among the most significant of these demonstrations. For my last example of music's place in the emergence of the new science, I would turn now to Isaac Newton, who in 1687 laid down the fundamental laws governing planetary motion. There are two aspects of his Principia Mathematica that I want to comment on because of their connections with earlier parts of his lecture. The first of these concerns Newton's success in analysing sound waves and deriving the speed of sound from the first principles of dynamics. What interests me most here is the model which enabled him to describe sound propagation mathematically. In brief, he made an analogy between the motion of a pendulum and particles of air oscillating backwards and forwards like tiny pendulums, each one obeying the laws of simple harmonic motion. In effect, he translated Hooke's intuitive qualitative model of matter in motion into one expressed in precise mathematical terms. Up to this point, the vibrating string and the physical pendulum had embodied earlier understandings of what we now call harmonic motion. Now these were replaced, not by another physical model, but by a mathematical relation. After Newton, this process of abstraction became accepted as a standard mathematical tool, independent from the physical realm, and musical models were no longer needed. The second feature of the Principia I want to comment on is the broader intellectual context within which Newton placed his own achievements. It may seem strange to us today, since we value innovation and novelty, but Newton did not see himself as a pioneer of universal gravitation. Instead, in a draft addition to the Principia, written around 1694, he looked back to Pythagoras as a mathematician and philosopher who, like himself, had discovered the fundamental laws of motion. Newton seems to have genuinely believed that the law of gravity was understood in ancient times, but that this knowledge was hidden from all but a few rare individuals who transmitted it secretly through cryptic means. In Newton's interpretation of the well-known legend of Pythagoras visiting the blacksmith, Pythagoras first discovered by experiment the inverse square relationship in the weights of hammers. From this discovery, Pythagoras went on to apply the same principle to the heavens, thinks Newton, and I quote, and consequently, by comparing those weights with the weights of the planets and the lengths of the strings with the distances of the planets, he understood, by means of the harmony of the heavens, that the weights of the planets towards the sun were reciprocally as the squares of the distances from the sun, and that, in other words, is the inverse square law. In his draft notes, Newton explains that Pythagoras concealed this divine knowledge from ordinary men, while at the same time revealing it to initiates such as himself, by means of allegory and symbolism. This explains why Newton took the story of Pythagoras discovering the simple ratios which govern consonants in the weights of the hammers seriously, whereas, as we have already seen a century earlier, Vincenzo Galileo dismissed that part of the legend because it was incorrect. For Newton, however, this mistake was no accident. Indeed, it was made deliberately to hide the truth about planetary motion. He believed that Pythagoras assumed that any true philosopher would check the story of the hammers by experiment. On finding the weight ratios were squared reciprocals, he would realize that the myth contained the hidden truth about the harmony of the cosmos, namely that Pythagoras was explaining the inverse square law theory of gravity rather than simply the characteristics of musical ratios. However, Newton never published this material, and it never became part of mainstream scientific thought. Instead, Newton himself was recognised as discovering the law of gravity, while at the same time the idea that the universe was constructed according to musical principles gradually lost its force. In this paper, I've shown the various ways that music was integral to the transformation of scientific thought in the 17th century scientific revolution. Galileo and his father, for example, were skilled lutenists whose intimate knowledge of the technology of their instruments not only led them to investigate the properties of vibrating strings, but also taught them how to measure musical time at a period when there were no mechanical timekeepers accurate enough to perform this task. Having proposed his new science of acoustics, Bacon urged natural philosophers to investigate the properties of musical instruments to discover the cause of harmony. Mersenne, on the other hand, actually carried out such investigations, leading him to discover the laws governing musical strings and the frequency of pendulums. A generation later, Hooke and Huygens were actively constructing devices using the principles of controlled vibration that Mersenne had established, namely the pendulum clock and the spring balance watch. Hooke also used Mersenne's laws as a basis for his fundamental theory of the universe. And finally, Newton, who apparently fled from a Handel opera just before the third act. Newton transcended all these musical analogies and relationships with his advanced use of mathematical concepts, which underpinned many forms of natural phenomena from gravity to music. Thus, we see that it was partly the use of musical instruments, not just what we would call scientific or mathematical instruments, which provided a subject sufficiently complex and sufficiently simple to be analysed experimentally and mathematically. The cognitive skills required for making music at a high level, particularly the ability to distinguish small units of time and pitch space, proved to be essential in the development of a universal measure. In other words, musical instruments and their sound provided an important context in which 17th century natural philosophers began to develop experimental and mathematical science as we now understand it. Thank you.